Hi, you're tuned to Truth News Radio Australia on the 25th of April 2015. My name's Hereward Fenton. 25th of April, folks, it's Anzac Day in Australia, one of the most important commemorations of war in this country, probably the most important, and also observed in New Zealand and recognised in a number of other countries around the world. Anzac Day is a commemoration of one of the most shocking and despicable military atrocities and blunders of all time. And I want to actually go through some of the shocking facts about Anzac Day and World War One. And I want to, in the show, reflect on the culture that has developed around Anzac Day in the last 10 to 20 years, which seems to be the product of an incredibly naive, incredibly militarized and Americanized culture that kind of has turned this solemn day of remembrance into something like a big day out. You know, it started around about the turn of the 21st century in Turkey, where people started turning up in large numbers to Anzac Cove at Gallipoli, where the landings occurred and where so many people died. And it kind of turned into like a big party, and there were people leaving garbage all around the place. It was kind of like a backpacker thing to go there. But what's most disturbing about it is that this phenomenon of the younger generation in Australia sort of naively and blindly looking up to this day, this event, this ceremony as something cool and something that we should celebrate. Whereas in fact, it was really just a commemoration of a terrible disaster, a terrible mistake, and a shocking loss of life that you know, per capita really hasn't been repeated. Even in World War II, the percentage of people who died in that conflict is just quite incredible, especially from an Australian point of view. And I want to actually just go through some of the statistics on that. And I also want to play to you a little video which was put together, which is up on YouTube, which documents some of the more important facts about the invasion. It wasn't indeed an invasion. Australia took part in an invasion of a sovereign nation, which was Turkey, which was part of the Ottoman Empire, who had never attacked us, who we really should have had no quarrel with. And that's another thing I want to get into talking about a little more today, because it's incredibly important and incredibly relevant, oddly, to things that are actually unfolding on the world stage in the last 20 years or so. So in that invasion, so many people died on both sides, and it achieved none of the military objectives that were believed would occur as a result. Now, let me just run through with you some of the salient statistics about the First World War and the storming of Gallipoli. Around 420,000 Australians enlisted for service in the First World War, representing 38.7% of the male population aged between 18 and 44. So that's a whopping great, you know, almost 40% of the military aged population enlisted. Now, in that conflict, 60,000 died. 60,000 Australian soldiers died, and 156,000 were wounded, gassed, or taken prisoner. So the total casualties, including captured, missing, wounded, or killed, was 215,000. And that actually represents 64% of the embarked soldiers, actually 65% to be exact, 64.98% of the embarked soldiers. And that is just a shocking number to keep in your head. And if you think of the number of people that actually were killed, 60,000 out of the 420,000 who went over there, that's roughly 1 in 7. That's roughly like the odds of playing Russian roulette with a revolver. That's the kind of risk that those guys were taking, and the devastation that wreaked on Australian society is easy to understand when you consider those numbers. Now, in the Gallipoli campaign, Australia's casualties were as follows. 8,700 dead, 19,444 wounded. It was the single worst event of that war, and that's why it became a commemoration. Even in 1916, it had already become a solemn occasion, and it was treated as something very serious and very solemn for many, many years. Of course, in later years, in later decades, there were protests against Anzac Day because there were huge protest movements against the Vietnam War in Australia, and it was recognised in those decades that this was something that we should not be treating as if it was okay, as if it was just a noble sacrifice that we had to perform. It was a blunder on the one hand, but on a much larger view of things, it was actually part of a strategy of empire and empire building, which is totally illegal, is totally inimical to civilization and democracy. And this is where it gets really interesting, folks, because it's actually very similar to what is actually happening now. We haven't had the massive casualties of Western troops in recent conflicts, but guess what? We're still involved in the same type of empire building in the same part of the world. And the little clip I'm about to play to you, which is part of a video, gets into some of that in a lot of detail. Now, this little video, which is titled Gallipoli, Lest We Forget the Facts, was produced just this year in April 2015 by John Rainford and Peter Ewer. And in it, it's very important because they get into the actual nature of what was going on, the larger strategy of what the British Empire was involved in doing. And it turns out, folks, that what they were up to was securing the oil fields in Iraq, because this was actually the beginning of the age of oil. This was the beginning of the switchover from coal to oil as the primary source of fuel. And that was, even that time, it was known that Iraq was one of the great prizes in terms of oil resources. Of course, the attack on Turkey was part of the destabilization of the Ottoman Empire, which was indeed quite successful in the long run. So even though we may say that the invasion of Gallipoli was a failure and a mistake and a blunder, it's kind of a misrepresentation to simply take it at face value, because as a result of the military incursions into Turkey, the Ottoman Empire did continue to crumble. And by the end of the First World War, the British had complete control of the Middle East. And this, of course, leads to the foundation of the State of Israel, as well as the Western acquisition of the incredibly valuable oil resources of Iraq and the Middle East. And this is something that people very rarely talk about in the context of World War I. Because we get preoccupied with what the Germans were doing and what the Russians were up to. And the disputes that took place that led to the outbreak of that war, which are all very complex, But I think one needs to understand that the world is ruled by empires and empire-building forces. And the proximal reasons and causes for the outbreaks of wars are often a distraction. You know, it may well be that the prime objective of World War I for the British was simply to get access to Iraq and the Holy Land. Because, of course, that was part of the agenda of Zionism. And, of course, all of this had direct consequences into the Second World War, which we know was somewhat engineered as well, as the Zionists wanted Jewish people in Germany to leave Germany. We know that. And there are historical documents to prove that. And the subsequent persecution of Jewish people in Germany, which took place, you know, not more than 15 years after the end of World War I, played into the hands of the Zionists, who were already benefiting from the fact that the British Empire had already kicked out the Ottoman Empire, and they had access to Palestine. So we start to see a different pattern in history when we look at it this way. But meanwhile, we have this popular culture of young people who are simply indoctrinated into a militaristic view, and it's got worse and worse over the last couple of decades. It's got incredibly more oversimplified and out of touch with the realities. And that, of course, has been fostered by the governments and the powers that be, including Labour and Liberal governments, who play up this whole Anzac myth and this concept of heroic sacrifice. And, of course, one of the worst contributors to that was, of course, John Howard, who was also the longest-serving Australian Prime Minister. And he kind of resuscitated this whole myth of Australia and Anzac and brought another generation of people into this kind of myopic celebration of really what was just mass murder. And we're talking about mass murder engineered by people in charge who knew exactly what was going to happen. They could see what would happen. They were incompetent, but worse than being incompetent, they didn't care. So when we get back from the break, I'm going to play to you a very interesting little clip which gets into some of these very interesting facts. Don't go away. With Truth News Radio. And to commemorate Anzac Day, I'm doing a little bit of a historical review of the Gallipoli invasion and World War I and the real agendas behind some of what happened at that period in history. And one thing to really hold in your mind, because we were never taught this at school, most Australians would kind of like their jaws would drop and they would stare at you agape. If you simply told them, well, we actually invaded a sovereign nation. That's what the storming of Gallipoli was. It was the invasion of a sovereign nation that we had no quarrel with. And to make it worse, we did it to serve the empire because the empire needed to secure oil resources. And when you put it like that, you realise, hey, that's just the same as the Iraq War of 2003 and 1991. It's the same thing. which means, hey, we learned nothing from history. We have not evolved in terms of basic principles of justice, truth, and respect for sovereign nations over a period of 100 years. So I'm going to play to you now a video, and I'm just playing you the audio clip from the video. I'll put the actual video, which is on YouTube, on our website. It's titled Gallipoli, Lest We Forget the Facts, and it's a film by Australians John Rainford and Peter Ewer, and it's really worth watching the video because they went to Turkey and they did a little bit of photography there on the beaches, and you can see the locations where the some of the key battles were fought, and they actually explain a lot of the details of the military strategy which was taking place. So I'll just cut now to that, and that'll probably take us to the end of the break and into the third segment of the show as well. Here we go.
The Gallipoli campaign. The Anzac spirit, Simpson and his donkey, comfortable legends for politicians to wave a flag around 100 years after the fighting. But why did so many die? Who sent them to fight? And how did things go so badly wrong?
The First World War was a battle of empires in a world that had reached the limits of imperial expansion. In the decades before 1914, the European powers, the United States and Japan, had carved up the world between them. Now, if you wanted more colonies, you had to take them, not off defenceless indigenous peoples, but off another world power who had already laid claim to them. Well before 1914, eager eyes had been cast on the Ottoman Empire, ruled by an ancient lineage of sultans, still vast in extent, but also in serious decline. As early as 1908, the British had told Russia that in the event of a new European war, Moscow could annex the Ottoman capital, Constantinople, modern-day Istanbul. 7 years later, a British planning committee confirmed the Russians could have the city and set out to finalise London's own ambitions.
Early in March last, the Russian government, anticipating an early and successful issue to the operations which had been started at the Dardanelles, communicated to the Allied governments its claims in regard to Constantinople. His Majesty's government agreed generally to the Russian proposals. The next step was, therefore, for His Majesty's government to formulate their definite desiderata in Asiatic Turkey.
What the British had on their list came down to one short word, oil. The ships of the Royal Navy were converting from coal to oil, and the richest oil fields of the day were in Iraq, then a Turkish province, and Persia, modern-day Iran. Turkey entered the First World War on the 5th of November 1914. The very next day, British troops landed at Basra to cement British control over the oil resources of the Middle East.
So, money and trade, the age-old motive for war. These explain why the Gallipoli campaign unfolded, but who ordered the invasion of Turkey?
The Gallipoli campaign was authorised by the British Liberal government, led by Prime Minister Herbert Henry Asquith, here laid to rest in the pretty yard of the All Saints Church, Sutton Courtenay, Oxfordshire.
Asquith was a politician of achievement, having pushed through important social reforms before the war. But not to put too fine a point on it, he was also a dirty old man, with a fondness for drink to boot. As Europe stood aghast at the horrors of the Western Front in the winter of 1914-15, Asquith was pursuing his latest young lady. Aged 62, he was besotted by aristocratic socialite Venetia Stanley, 35 years his junior.
The other politician at the heart of the Gallipoli adventure was, of course, Winston Churchill, First Lord of the Admiralty, political head of the Royal Navy. Impetuous, indifferent to methodical planning, Churchill's boyish enthusiasm for the war was matched only by his thirst for alcohol. The high living of the British politicians was part of the hedonistic social milieu around the Asquith government. Asquith's eldest son, Raymond, was a member of the Coterie, a society circle that included Venetia Stanley and at least one of Asquith's cabinet colleagues, notorious for its consumption of alcohol and morphine.
So these were the Edwardian dilettantes who sent so many men to their deaths. But what did the Australian government know?
On the 2nd of March 1915, 6 weeks before the landing, London told Australia and New Zealand that the Anzacs were on their way to Gallipoli, but this was for information only. The Australian government had so little to do with the decision-making that the fighting would be underway for nearly 3 months before the Australian politicians asked for maps with enough detail to allow them to work out where their troops were. So with this combination of naked imperial ambition and political ineptitude, Britain set out to conquer Turkey. The British aimed to force the Dardanelles, the waterway between the Mediterranean and the Black Sea, and then bombard Constantinople into submission. First, Churchill egged on his admirals, against their better judgment, to make the attempt with ships alone, sending a massive fleet to attack the Turkish forts guarding the straits on the 18th of March 1915. The result was a disaster. The might of the Royal Navy was effectively brought undone by a single Turkish ship, the tiny Nusret. In the dead of night, the Nusret secretly laid a line of naval mines in the path of the Allied fleet. Blundering onto them, three battleships were sunk in short order and the British withdrew. Back in London, the Asquith government digested this defeat, albeit the Prime Minister had other things on his mind.
My darling, you have just left me, and I feel very desolate. You were, as you always are, your real self today. Sweet, resolute, and deceiving. I know no woman, and have never known one, who could be in any comparable degree all three things at once. I don't say there is no pain in it, but it is at such moments, in the fresh bitterness of parting, and with the clouded uncertainties of an impenetrable future, that I realise how wise and heaven-blessed I was to have found and appropriated and encased in my heart of hearts what the scripture calls the pearl of great price.
What battleships couldn't do, men with rifles would. The British assembled an army, including the Anzacs, and put General Sir Ian Hamilton in charge of it. Hamilton personified the Edwardian British Army. Generals got jobs not on merit, but because they were next in line or knew someone of influence. He had some good ideas, but not the drive to force subordinates to implement them. Even Asquith thought Hamilton had too much feather in his brain. With events in the balance, Asquith turned to Venetia Stanley for advice.
Hankey has just been in. Very anxious about the Dardanelles, which he says Robertson, chief of French's staff, describes as the stiffest operation anyone could undertake. Now that things look better with Italy and Romania, Hankey strongly urges postponement, lest a check there should set back the whole situation. There is a great deal of force in this. What do you think?
Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. And I'm just playing you today a clip from a little YouTube documentary that explains some of the lesser-known facts about Gallipoli and the First World War. So that will continue for the rest of this segment, and I may have some comments about it before we get to the end of the show today. So just returning you now to the video titled Gallipoli, Lest We Forget the Facts.
History does not record what Venetia Stanley thought Asquith should do. Meanwhile, Hamilton came up with a complicated plan to force the issue. This involved landings in two different sectors, the first on a wide, flat beach north of a point called Gaba Tepe, on the west coast of the peninsula. Here, Hamilton gave the Anzacs their role to seize high ground running south from the high point of Chunuk Bear. They were commanded by British General William Birdwood. He had some bright ideas, but not all of them were good ones.
To achieve surprise, Birdwood landed the Anzacs at night. But the consequence was that they were landed in the wrong spot, carried north by the current to land here at North Beach under these horrendous cliffs. The key feature of which, of course, is the aptly named Sphinx.
Landing in places like this, in the dark and further south at Anzac Cove itself, the Australians and New Zealanders were soon in desperate trouble. Men had no idea where they were, and their officers soon lost control as units were swallowed up in the gullies and scrub-covered ravines. But the Anzacs were also beaten by a brilliant general, Mustafa Kemal, later the founder of modern Turkey. Unlike Hamilton, who watched events passively and did nothing to influence the outcome of the battle, Kemal took decisive action and counterattacked hard. And the bravery of his troops was without peer. Of the Turkish 57th Infantry Regiment, which led the charge, not a single man survived the war. With the Anzacs stuck on the cliff tops further south at Cape Helles, Hamilton landed the British 29th Division at five separate beaches. The 29th was led by General Hunter Weston, the kind of dull-witted officer oblivious to casualties that gave rise to the caricature of the incompetent British commander, Colonel Blimp. Hunter Weston's objective was a small hill that dominated the southern tip of the peninsula, Archie Baba.
Archie Baba, not much of a hill to die for, but thousands did. And when you reach the summit, it's clear why. The view from that little hill dominates the entire southern end of the Dardanelles Peninsula. And so, it was to reach this point that the British set themselves on the 25th of April 1915.
The landings at each flank at Helles, at S Beach and Y Beach, were surprisingly successful.
This beautiful spot is Y Beach, and the place where the British came closest to complete success on the 25th of April. Ian Hamilton himself selected the place as somewhere where a surprise landing might be made, and the two battalions who landed here achieved just that. They climbed these cliffs completely unopposed and then did nothing.
The problem was that the British stuck to their plan rather than exploited success where they found it. The forces at Y Beach and S Beach were only meant to protect the main landings at X, W, and the largest of all, V Beach. At these places, the invading troops were shot down en masse by Turkish infantry firing from strongly fortified positions. Hunter Weston, lacking the imagination to change a plan going badly wrong, sent his men into this fire until at V Beach the sea ran red with their blood. The 29th Division, like the Anzacs, eventually won a toehold ashore, but that was all. Failure on the first day could never be recovered, and Gallipoli became a siege, despite another attempted landing further north at Suvla Bay in August 1915. Gallipoli ended in defeat for the British and the Anzacs in December 1915, when the remaining troops were evacuated. 2,779 New Zealanders and 8,709 Australians would die at Gallipoli, but the British eventually got what they wanted, the Iraqi oil fields. It would take another 3 years of mass slaughter on the Western Front, but when the First World War ended, Britain took possession of Iraq under an international mandate.
Gallipoli, lest we forget the facts.
Okay, so let's consider now the First World War as a whole. Just reading from Wikipedia, the total number of casualties was over 37 million. Over 16 million deaths and 20 million wounded. By country, combat deaths, the highest percentage per capita of combat deaths was actually from Australia. Deaths as percent of population in Australia was around about 1.3%. Total number of deaths was over 60,000. Canada, also very, very high death toll, over 60,000. India, 60 to 70,000. New Zealand, tiny country, and I'm sorry I misrepresented that. I think New Zealand had the highest per capita death rate from the war. It only had a population of 1.1 million. And the deaths as percentage of population of New Zealand was 1.5%. The United Kingdom lost 700,000 troops. 700,000. France lost 1,385,000. I mean, these numbers are just staggering. In a world that was a much smaller place compared to now in terms of population. The Russian Empire lost 1.8 million. Of course, the Russians lost a lot more than that in World War II. Now, in the light of that, and looking at the current militarism and the current kind of rush to war that we see again and again as a way to solve problems, I have to say, folks, that I'm very, very worried about our future, because our history is littered with these catastrophic events, catastrophic death tolls as a result of military conflicts. We have been spared that over the past generation, but other countries haven't. You know, other countries have suffered greatly from our military adventures. And think about the Vietnam War. Estimated 3 million Vietnamese lost their lives in that conflict. The estimates for the number of people who died in the Iraq conflict are well over a million. I think it's around about 1.5 based on projections and estimates. We are on the brink of another kind of military catastrophe, I believe. And we need to completely destroy the myth of the noble sacrifice. How more can I say it? It is a complete lie and an offence to anyone of good conscience to use that. We are going to break. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
What happens in terms of creating wars is a mind manipulation technique called problem reaction solution. And it works like this. And it works like this. First of all, you create the problem, but you get someone else to be blamed for it. You then report that problem through the media in the way you want it reported. You get the public to react to your problem by saying something must be done, this can't go on, what are they?
Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. My name's Hereward Fenton. Great to be bringing you this show today on this 100th anniversary of the Gallipoli invasion, which Australia was part of. That was an invasion of a sovereign nation done for the purposes of empire and resource acquisition. Now, folks, the media, of course, is going berserk with this story today. It is really being hyped up. This is a major event, and it is being used as a major kind of psyop, a major kind of NLP anchoring tool to hook people in to the cult of war, the cult of death. It is really very, very worrying development to see this happening, knowing as we do the agendas of the powers concerned, that they haven't changed, that the same utterly evil people are still running our countries, and that they will use this cult of death to sucker you in to future disasters, future military disasters which have yet to be to come to realization. The dawn service at Gallipoli this year in Turkey was probably the biggest ever. And major figures from around the world have turned up, including Prince Charles, who has given a long and deeply stirring speech about the great and grand and noble sacrifice that was made. Let me just actually quote to you a little here from Prince Charles's address. I'm sure you probably get this on the internet, but I'll just quote to you. I don't actually have access to the video feeds right now. I'll read to you a few paragraphs of what Charlie had to say. I suspect that many of those here today may be of my own generation, born some 30 years after the end of the First World War, and whose grandfathers and great uncles may easily have fought or lost their lives in this most bloody of campaigns. When I was young, I remember talking to the then Field Marshal, Lord Slim, about his recollections of the battles in which he was ultimately badly wounded. But when the Anzacs finally left this place, they were tormented by the thoughts of leaving their comrades behind, that their suffering and loss would be forgotten, and that their graves would lie untended. Lieutenant Ken Miller of the 2nd Battalion wrote, "There was the question of our dead mates. We lived at Gallipoli with our dead alongside us. Owing to the lack of space, our cemeteries were always under our eyes. The hardest feature of the evacuation was in leaving those dead comrades behind. They had bequeathed us a sacred trust. As the parties stole away from the line, they took off their hats, passing the crosses, and the old, hard-bitten Anzacs wept silent tears. They did indeed bequeath us a sacred trust, a trust we honour today." Anyway, look, that's just a taste of the tone of the address by Prince Charles. And as you can see, there is no reflection in this. There is no reflection of how wrong it was, how it should be a lesson never to be repeated. I mean, there are some reasons, I believe, for commemorating an event such as Gallipoli, but only if it's done by way of teaching us a lesson never to be repeated. When it's done simply as a vehicle to pitch the emotional NLP kind of anchor that this is for the greater good and that these people did a noble sacrifice, that then will drag in future generations into doing similar actions, then really it is a great evil which is being perpetrated by the way this is being now turned into such a grand event. And why? Why is it such a grand event? Simply because so many people died. And this is what you have to understand about the logic and the dynamics of the utterly evil and utterly ruthless people who rule this planet, is that they use death. They use, as Joseph Conrad said, and as Francis Ford Coppola so brilliantly portrayed in the film Apocalypse Now, they use the horror, as their primary mechanism of societal control. Think about 9/11. Think about the Bali bombing. Catalysts which emotionally paralyzed, traumatized, and bonded people to an agenda. Death and horror are incredibly powerful tools in the hands of very, very, very evil people. And that's why, you know, folks, I think we have to become immune to horror. This, again, was in Coppola's film, which is worth watching again if you haven't watched it recently. Because in those final scenes with Marlon Brando, which I think was a deviation from the script of the original novel, which of course was a Joseph Conrad novel, he talks about becoming impervious to horror and how the only way people can actually win is that they have to become immune to horror. They have to actually embrace horror deep within themselves and learn to accept it. Because if you don't learn to accept it, it will control you. And this is how nations are drawn in to wars that they would never have embarked upon, through horror. As soon as someone lets off a bomb in a public place and starts killing random people, or a bomb drops on your house or your neighbor's house, killing people you know, the horror is unleashed upon you. And if you are not emotionally fit enough to understand what's going on and to not be suckered by that, you will simply then become like a zombie Trojan in the hands of those who are running this conflict, because they do it specifically to get you involved. Every war has started off this way. Every war is begun by deliberate unprovoked acts of aggression against random, harmless, innocent people. This happened in Syria. Anonymous men with guns started shooting people in the streets. This happened in Yugoslavia at the beginning of that conflict. Random acts of terrorism, activating old conflicts, old animosities, causing people to turn against each other. Of course, it happened with Australia's involvement in the Iraq War over the Bali bombing. We were horrified and mobilised. So I'd like to just try and convey with this show the message that we must become immune to horror. And I know that's an awful thing to say. And I certainly don't want to become emotionally hardened so that we don't feel other people's pain, that we lose compassion. But we have to be strong. We have to be strong. And we have to communicate this to others so they understand. Because a time will come when Australia may be subjected to more of this type of horror. For now, it's mostly been things that have happened overseas. We haven't actually had horror on our own shores, but it's come very close. So let me just finish now with some ABC News coverage of the Anzac Day events, and that will be our show for this week. I will be back next week, and I'm really looking forward to getting some great interviews for you. So do stay listening to the show. I'm in this for the long haul, folks. And we'll just continue now to the end of the segment with some ABC news coverage of Anzac Day.
The Australian War Memorial in Canberra has always held the nation's largest dawn service, but this year was something else. 50,000 people were expected, 120,000 turned up, almost a third of Canberra's population. Images of our war dead loomed large over the crowd, but it was their individual stories read by current war heroes that made the impact.
But if I am to die, know that I die loving you with my whole heart and soul, dearest wife that a man ever had. Kiss little Gwen and our new baby, who perhaps I may never see, and never let them forget Daddy.
Currumbin's beachside dawn service has become southeast Queensland's Anzac Day Mecca. About 30,000 locals gathered in front of Elephant Rock as the sun rose behind it. And out on the water, there was a special tribute too.
Yeah, very moving, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was beautiful.
Especially being at the beach as well.
I think everybody that came loved every minute of it. It was exceptional.
In Sydney, every inch of Martin Place and the streets leading into it were filled with those who came to remember. Under a rising sun, the breaking dawn, and a crowd forever grateful to the men who signed up for war at enlistment offices on this very spot.
Okay, I'll just have to interject at this point, I'm afraid, because that statement there that was injected by the ABC commentator, that people are forever grateful for what was done on that day, is palpably absurd, and I personally find it really offensive. It's also a lie. And do bear in mind that we're being lied to. We're being lied to about what happened. We're being lied to about what people really think about what happened. We're a whole false reality is created for us. And my purpose with this show is simply to shed a little bit of light on these facts. That's our show for this week. See you next week, folks.